Welcome back to Beyond Classified. I am Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Johnny Bynum. He is author of 9 books and considered a dog of war turned spiritual warrior. He also studied traditional Chinese medicine for 9 years to be the first Westerner in Australia to have his own clinic. Johnny, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Not as good as you, Chris, but I'm working on it. I'm working on it, mate.
Oh, great. Well, let's see. Hopefully we can get you there. I want to thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have a good talk tonight because you were, man, before the show, you were telling me some really interesting stories. You've led an incredible life, and we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about not only the incredible life that you've led, but some of your insights into the nature of our strange reality. And it seems that we're in a spiritual battle globally at the moment. I'd like to talk a little bit about your insights into that. And like I said, you've led a very adventurous life, which has taken you across the globe and through not just one, but 3 wars, and on an amazing spiritual journey. So we have a lot to cover in a very short amount of time. So Johnny, you're from Australia, right? Let's start at the beginning. What was your childhood in Australia like?
I had the most amazing childhood. It was Australia's version of Camelot. I was absolutely free. I was a bush boy, Tully, North Queensland. I saw my parents after breakfast, and I never saw them again until late that evening. And they just we just went about our business and as kids, and we were totally free. I had the privilege of my father never telling me not to do anything. The only thing he ever said to me not to do was hit women. I might have shot a few, but I've never hit any. So, but it was an amazing, and it was absolutely, totally, totally carefree. And we it's the tropics, of course. We grew up in the tropics, and so that was great. And I never wore any shoes. And I can remember it was during the Second World War, and Americans were there. We made friends with them, and they could not work out because it's so hot, and it used to get so hot that the bitumen on the road, the bitumen would melt. And we didn't have any shoes, just walked in the shoes, and at the end of the day, you'd peel all this bitumen off. But they couldn't imagine how you could walk on this bitumen. But our feet were just as thick as any Zulu warrior. And so that was an amazing childhood. And then I detested school. I went to the Christian Brothers for a couple of years. I detested that. Detested them. I wanted adventure. I wanted freedom, and that's all I ever wanted. And so I didn't run off from home, but I ran away from my hometown, I suppose. I just wanted adventure. Get out there. And I remember an Elizabethan once said, he said, I will open the world. I will prick it open with my sword. And I thought I'd be able to do it through probably army or something like that, but it didn't work out. But anyway, so that was my beginnings. And just a carefree childhood and wonderful parents. It was a wonderful time. Very little, just different. People had come back from the Second World War. It was a time of plenty. Everybody had jobs. There was jobs for everybody. Australia then was an amazing place. We had free education. Everything was free. Medicine was free. I was 1,000 miles from the capital. If you had a heart attack or something, they flew you down to the capital. It didn't cost you a penny for your medicine. That was all paid through either lotteries or taxes. We owned everything. We Australia had total sovereignty. We owned the singlet, the shoes, everything you wore. We had manufacturing industries, and that was all, like I say, very much like in America. That was just sent off overseas, and so there's virtually not much. We had our planes, our own cars. All this was gone, very much a little bit like America, but I think the only industry you've got in America today that's is making weapons, and that's the military industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned about. He said, that was one of his last warnings. He just said, And another thing Eisenhower said, he said, he said, every bomb, every bullet, every missile that you make is actually taking money away from your child's future. Yeah, so the money that's invested to war is not, well, it can't be used for things that's going to bring peace to the woods, to the world. So he was a remarkable person, Eisenhower. And also the other thing about Eisenhower was that there was not an American serviceman killed on battle under his watch as a president. A little bit unusual for American presidents.
Yes, it is very unusual. Now, speaking of, you know, military-industrial complex and war, what was it that got you interested in being in the military yourself, and what branch did you join?
I had arrived in Sydney, didn't have a job, and I met a couple of Scandinavian seamen. And their trick was to go to join the military, and that took a couple of days. So they had food for a couple of days, and then at the last minute before you signed up, they'd ask you, after you sign up, you belong to us, and they'd say, no, we'll think about it. So I went out, but I thought, this is not bad. Showers, food, sounds interesting to fight in Korea. So I thought, I'll join up. They said, you're crazy. No, I'll join up. So that was it. I really had known nothing. I just, where's Korea? I knew the name, but I didn't know where I was, what was going on. So that's, I just grew up and I just thought, it'd be an adventure, and which it was. But the thing was, I had to put up my age 4 years because my parents, no way they'd let me in. So I just hit 18. So I put it up to 22. This way I didn't have to give my parents consent. So I was in to the army. I was 22 years old. In actual fact, I was only 18. So that was why I joined. But after that, I think it's the adrenaline. I came back, and then after I was in the commandos, I was the first person put in for officer school in the commandos, and I was 3 months too old. So I had a letter to the stating that, so I left them. But later I just couldn't handle, I suppose, I'd been married for a few years and Borneo, that's the Indonesian confrontation was on, and Vietnam. So I just said to my wife, look, I said, this is killing me. I said, I've got to join. She said, okay. She said, that's your nature. So I had her blessing and I joined. And so then I went to the Indonesian confrontation, Borneo. In Vietnam, I was an infantryman, simply an infantry. That's just a frontline soldier. A guy in the intelligence section got killed, and I replaced him, and they kept me. And so then I was doing more or less intelligence work, and then sometimes doing a bit of work, helping people get behind the lines, or just all odd jobs. Something I want to mention, it was with the Americans, and they were a friend of mine, Charlie Mitchell. He said, listen, he said, I've got all this whiskey, because the Australian Army is not dry. So during the war, if we got a chance, they give us a beer, a couple of bottles of beer a day, and the officers, they get there free. And the officers get a whiskey allocation, but they don't always drink it. So my friend, he was a driver, actually, of the intelligence section, and he said, I can get all this American whiskey. Let's go to the Yanks and sell it to them. I said, okay, fair enough. So the two of us went over, and there was a company of Marines, and they were all lined up, and they were just waiting to go across this open field, the paddy fields. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning, very bright, sunny day. Anyway, Charlie went to the officer in charge, and he said, they gave him a bottle of whiskey, and he said, can we sell it to your men? He said, yeah, no problem. So we went out and we sold all our whiskey. So then the Marines, about 200 company, around 200 lined up, and they weren't expecting them. They just expected to walk across the valley, and there was to a place called, there were features called East and West Berlin. But anyway, they went about maybe 400 meters, with yards, and suddenly mortars, machine guns, bum, 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 bum. And so we moved our vehicle back. And the Marines, they all hit the ground. And There were mortars, machine guns, everything exploding amongst them, and some were obviously hit. But the thing about that, and which is still so vivid in my mind, even at this moment, no one ran. Yeah, they were there, they were stuck, they were that, but they, no one went forward either. I was really impressed at the fact that they just there. They obviously kept in control, and I think they probably would have called off the attack because there was bad intelligence. I mean, why would you attack a place 9 o'clock in the morning or go across? You'd either go at, you'd be formed up, you go there at night and be formed up at the bottom of the feature in the morning or whatever. So, but that's something that stands in my mind. So, we fought with the Americans, so both in Korea and more so in Vietnam. I had a lot to do with the Americans and servicemen, so I got to know them really well, and made some really good friends, especially in Vietnam. With Vietnam and Borneo, I just went over there in Vietnam. I was with the Army Intelligence. I was full time intelligence then, so my job wasn't in the jungle. It was working with various groups, including the CIA, and we did our own operations. And we used to do snatch and grabs, and we worked very much with the Americans. And I worked with the guy in charge of that was a guy called Bob Heady. Now, I used to have talks with some of the CIA, and I thought they were clowns. I thought they were bloody idiots. But Bob Heady, he made up for them. He was smart. He was clever, and he had this type of personality that, you know, there were Vietnamese, there were Australians, there was different groups there, but he had a personality that could work with everybody, and he was a remarkable man. But I wasn't impressed with the CIA at all in a lot of the things and the way they went about things. And the thing about that, in we had a province called Phuc Thuy Province, and when I went there, there was a curfew. But when I left, you could go around the province day or night. The Australians in our province, we'd won our war. And after the other thing that I really was proud of, as far as that was concerned, was these Viet Cong, previous enemy, who they were interviewing, the Australian journalists were interviewing them, and one had one eye and one arm, and they'd lost it fighting the Australians. And they said, look, you never raped any women, you didn't burn down any villages, and you treated the civilians with respect. And he said, so we've always respected you as an enemy, but we didn't think you fought fair. So they're telling us, we didn't fight fair, so that was the other thing. But that was great to hear that from the enemy. Whereas, you know, the Americans, you know, they would wander into a village, and that village would, I mean, really, it was Apocalypse Now. That movie you saw, yeah. You saw them wipe out. That was real. The storyline was far fetched, but the things that went on. That's the way it was. And the enemy, when you wipe out a village, mate, you've recruited for the Viet Cong. The sons and daughters, they're your enemy.
Now, Johnny, you said you worked with the CIA and did something called snatch and grabs. Could you talk a little bit about that and what you did for the CIA exactly?
What we did was with the intelligence, we had a black list and we had a grey list. And if anybody's name came up, because we had Vietnamese interpreters, we had documents come in, we had people we caught, captured, interrogated in our way, and we didn't torture them. I'll have to diversify there, because half our unit was Vietnamese. And they did use torture. And in fact, I was there one night, and my boss, Captain Bosco, and another guy, Kyle Leach, were there. Kyle Leach and I won some award for something or other. I don't know what the award was. I don't even know what it was that we won the award for, but I never got it anyway. But Captain Chung, Dai Wee Chung, he said to everybody there, look, we've used torture with prisoners, but he said, we're not going to use torture from this point onwards. And the reason was, Captain Bosco, my boss, said, if you give me information, that's to just get the Vietnamese side of his unit, and I know you've used torture to get that information, I will not use it, even though Australian soldiers might die as a result. He said, I refuse to use information that got through torture. So Dai Wee Tung said, we will never use torture again. We'll use whatever means, but we won't use torture. So that I know. Another time, I took a prisoner to Binh Hoa province, the Americans, and this guy, I couldn't speak Vietnamese, he couldn't speak much English, but we shared a cigarette on a helicopter, and I was to take him up there and sign him off, and it was about a 40-minute trip on the helicopter, and I arrived there, and I'm signing the papers to sign him over, and I'm in this office, and I hear this almighty screams and screams and screams. What's going on? They said, oh, that guy you just bought, they're ringing him up. I said, well, yeah, that's torturing him. You know, they got electrodes to his testicles and ringing him up on an electrical thing. I thought, God, they wouldn't even know his name. They're already torturing him, you know? Oh, and I was so angry. The thing is, if they'd have been out, I'd shot them. But I couldn't because, I mean, I wouldn't have got to the helicopter. And it was waiting. And so anyway, I was totally impotent. I couldn't help the guy, and I could hear the guy screaming. And contrarily, we had a guy called Kiet. He had 13 spies, his own group. And we had him, but in our unit, we gave him the run of the unit. He couldn't leave the unit, but we had our weapons there and this and that, but we treated him. We had a party. He was there. We got drunk. He was there. We ate, and he was ate with us. He ate the same food as us. But he gave us all this information. Now, the Americans had him for a week, and I know they tortured him, and he refused to give them any information, and they sent him back to us. But he gave us that. He gave us books of information, but nothing about the 13 spies that he had. We didn't ask him. We respected him. We didn't. But he gave us all this information. So it was gaining the person's confidence and so forth. And like I remember saying to Kiet, I said, mate, he said to us, he said, look, at a party, he said, we'll outlast you. He said, you won't last us. He said, we will outlast you. And I said, well, you know, you might cop it, Kiet. He said, doesn't matter. He said, but we'll outlast you. And they did. And so that was it's a very personal thing, and there's no like life, there's no black or white. It's all shades of gray, you know, and people, you know, there's no good person, there's no bad person. Everyone has a capacity to do good, and everyone has a capacity to do evil or wrong, and most of us, I've done my fair share of both. So am I a good person or a bad person? Well, mate, I've done my bad things. I've fed the beast, but I've done some good too. You know, so,
right.
And that applies to everybody. I don't find anybody's completely either black or white. You know.
Oh yeah. Evil or... Definitely. Now you were in three wars. You are in Korea, Vietnam, and what was the third one?
Indonesian confrontation.
Now that was what? When... Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, actually, what that was when. The America, England, and various countries, and they Malaysia wanted to be a separate country, and Indonesia didn't want that because Indonesia is next to Malaysia, and they thought that'd be a military threat. So President Sukarno, the president of the time, and he started the confrontasi, the confrontation with Malaysia, and Borneo, and so. That went on for a number of years, and there was a Malaysian war and the Indonesian confrontation. They more or less got combined. The Malaya was just a communist insurgents, but what happened? That was because you have insurgents in both in Afghanistan and Vietnam, and it's interesting because the English. They were the only ones who actually had a counterinsurgency war that was won by the Allies. And what they did was they simply, which didn't happen in Vietnam. I spoke to the CIA guys about this. I mean, These are a couple of heads of the CIA who came there. And I said, why didn't you do it like in Malaya? Because in Malaya, they took all the people out of the small villages and put them in larger towns, but they secured them. They made them absolutely secure. They gave them houses. They put the kids in school. They gave the kids an education. Everyone was well fed, but you were locked off from the countryside. So their idea was you chop the head off and you separate it from the body. And literally, they starved the people out, the insurgents, because they couldn't get... insurgency only works when they can get amongst the people by day or by night to get food, medicine, and also give their propaganda and kill any of their enemies. So when you separate that and the insurgents can't get at the people, the insurgency, you've taken the power away from the insurgency. So when they did that, and then they just take parts of the area that was occupied by the insurgents, and they just dropped paratroopers out of the planes and they'd land right into the jungle, and some have been caught in trees and so forth. So it was successful. Anyhow, that it just petered out until there was only about 20 left at the end. The leader was a guy called Chin Peng, and he just surrendered, and that was the end of that. But that never happened, you know. And what the English did was they made the people, the inhabitants, secure. Now, in Vietnam, that never happened. You wiped out the villages and belonged to these people. You never made them secure. You know, they had the Americans and the Vietnamese by day, and then they had the Viet Cong by night, and very much the same in Afghanistan. You know, there's an old saying: you build your castle first, then you sally forth. You build that castle, then you go out into the outside, and then you take over bit by bit. But you build that castle first, and that's what the English did. They made their areas secure for the people. And if you, in a counterinsurgency, an insurgency war, in any war, if you don't, it's really a hearts and minds situation to get the people behind you. And if you can't do that, you're not going to win the war. And you know, with drones sort of floating around there. Doesn't matter what side you're on. When you've got a drone overhead, you're scared. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're this side or that side. So it's all counterproductive, you know. Essentially, it's about people. Have you looked after the people? Yes or no? Or did you make it secure for them? Yes or no? If you haven't, well, mate, don't expect to win. And I don't feel, you know, they're not wars like in Korea or in the Second World War where you were full frontal attacks and there's the enemy and there you are. These are wars to do with people's minds. You know, even in America today, or Australia or anywhere, you know, there's a war going on, you know, with information, disinformation. It's about people and people's minds and people, how they feel, how secure they feel, how do they feel about the future?
I definitely have to agree with you on that one, and I want to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But first, I want to know, when did your involvement with the military end, and how did it come to an end?
I literally finished 6 years when I joined up for the last time. I did 6 years. It came to an end. And then that's not entirely true. I was then as an instructor, part-time instructor in an army intelligence. And I did that. But then I was into, I had to support a family. So I started my own business. So I was in jewelry, sculpture, stuff like that. And opal, mainly opals. So I just went full-time with that. And I grew a beard just to show I was no longer in the military. And although I did sign up I got a bit bored and I thought, oh, it wouldn't hurt to go. And in Africa, there was a few wars going on. I thought, oh, I might join them. And more or less as a mercenary, which I'm not you know, just I'm not particularly proud of, but it was more, I wasn't nicked about that. I just wanted a bit of adventure. I just like was, you know, civilian life was killing me, boring. And, but anyway, I said to my, there was at the time that the Arabs in the Gulf states, they had some counterinsurgency wars, and some Australians used to go over there, even some army officers and men in their 3 weeks leave, they'd go over there and fight for the Gulf states against the insurgents there in their holidays. And I thought, I could do that. So I told my wife, and she said, don't be a bastard all your life. She said, let the kids finish their high school, then you can do what you like. So I said, okay, fair enough. Let's be sensible about this. So that was the end of it, Chris. I said, can't be a bastard all your life. Yeah. So anyway, so that was the end of that. And in fact, I really became very anti-military. I wouldn't watch a war movie or anything.
Well, I was just about to ask you, what changed your mind about basically opened your eyes to the way the military really operates when it comes to these wars that we've been involved with and that we're still involved with, basically?
Well, you've got, I don't know where it is. He's the highest American decorated. He had two Congressional Medals of Honor. But anyhow, the book that he wrote, it's only about a 100-page book called Wars Are a Racket. So, I was pretty much well aware of that because I could see corruption and different things like that. But really, it's when you start to write and investigate, and I love history and military history. So when you go into that, you just realize, I mean, Churchill, after the First World War, he said, we killed the wrong people, meaning they should have killed the banking system, the bankers. He said, they're the ones they should have killed. You know, he said, we killed the wrong people. You know, in any war, people, business people become millionaires. And if there's another war, those millionaires become billionaires. So this is normal. And it doesn't matter where you are. And today, you've got this, the military industrial complex of different countries. And there's all the stuff. I mean, now I can't tell you what it is at the moment, but certainly about 15 years ago, the Americans used to loan Israel $75 million a year to support it. The thing is, the rider is that 75% of that 75 million had to be used to buy American weapons for Israel. So you're supporting Israel. You're supporting Israel, but you're supporting the military industrial complex.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
You're just giving it to you to pay it back here. So this is what it is. Look, the only thing. There's a few things that we, the public, have got. No one likes to be laughed at. Doesn't matter whether it's Trump, Biden, Putin, Xi Jinping. No one likes to be laughed at. I don't like to be laughed at. I laugh with me, but no one likes to be laughed at. So this is something, so satire, cartoons, the press, turning some of these people into a joke. That's one of the few things we have. Actually, the thing that we do have, I wrote a poem about it called A Construct of People's Power, and that is, but the people have so much power, people power. It's not called people power for nothing. But where's the personality who can organize it and bring that people together, or it's an idea or an ideal? For instance, if say we could do that and we could organize the people and really get them behind us, and what we're not, we're doing this for good, that people say, yes, that's good. But we need to demonstrate our power. And so we got the people and we said, okay, we're not going to drink, we'll say Pepsi or Coke. We'll say, okay, we decided we're not going to drink Coke. Now, all of us suddenly are not going to drink Coke. We can drink anything else, but we're not going to drink Coke. Now, the moment you did that and you've got a mass movement behind you, Coke doesn't make their sales. Coke loses their shares. Coke is destroyed. And the people have simply done it because they just decided, we're not going to do that. Now, take this to landmines. There's only some countries that make landmines. For instance, cluster bombs. America is one of the few countries, just about nearly every country in the world has signed that they won't use or manufacture cluster bombs. These are the bombs that drop out of a plane and they just spread, they go all the countryside and they're still blowing limbs and mainly off kids and farmers and things like that. And they're everywhere, there's millions of them. But the United States of America won't sign that treaty, won't sign that. So I know fiat, I know I don't know now, so I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I know fiat fiat as a company used to make landmines or cluster bombs. So if you've got a mass movement, there's things now that's no good for anybody. So the companies within that country, whatever companies that are making those, then you simply do not buy any of those products. Today, I won't buy a fiat product. If I know it's fiat, I'm just sorry, not interested, because you made cluster bombs. You know, so people have that power, but what we don't have is that person that we can really trust or a movement that we can really trust. So at the moment, Chris, I'm afraid it's people like yourself, really. There is that movement already. There's people like yourself. There are other people out there, Rockfin and various people. But what they're doing is they're giving people a voice and trying to sort out what is really going on from all the crap that's going out. They say, oh, we're off to Mars and Venus and so forth to discover, is there life? Hang on, Look, if you've got 20 people there in a room, at least five of those people, or certainly three of those people, have had some experience with UFO. They've had a personal experience. They know there's UFOs. They know there's people. They know there's extraterrestrials. And here's NASA and the government say, we're off to Mars to see if there's life. Give me a break. You've got this lie. There's this really good looking, I forget his names. He's a young, good looking English professor. And he's there and he has these wonderful programs. And we're off to, is there life here? Is there life there? We're trying to discover it. They're there, the crop circles. I mean, some crop circles are nothing, but other crop circles are so complex, so incredible. And the straw is bent over and it's not broken. It's just been bent over and fused. And it's amazing stuff. And so all this stuff is around us and going on. National Geographic, and I subscribe to National Geographic because it's giving you the latest on what's happening with the planet in many ways. But it said, crop circles are a hoax. And that's not true. There are people who get out there and do things, but they're pretty basic stuff. They're not 8 miles long, some of these things that are. There's a one in Australia that was 15 miles long.
Oh, wow.
Up on the mountain. The Maori man. You couldn't even get a tractor up there, And it's disappeared now. It's got its dust, but it was an Aboriginal made out. So, who's doing that? So, and they're saying, is there life? So there's all this stuff around us that even it's not even common sense.
It also seems that we're moving, we kind of touched on this earlier, that we're moving away from kind of traditional warfare with tanks and bombs and guns, and we're moving to this age of information war and psychological war, and that seems to be the more prevalent theme now. Do you see the same thing, that that is going to eventually probably take more precedence over these old, traditional warfare that we used to fight?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, it's happening now.
There's
a whole range of military stuff that they're using, rays, and but both the Russians and the Americans, and also the other thing, which an American major who's ex Afghanistan, a very smart guy. I love people who really love history, because we see in history the same things being repeated over and over and over again, how people are manipulated and so forth. But he says the big thing is, and which I did not realize, but the CIA now have military. When I knew the CIA, they were simply an intelligence organization like MI5, MI6. But now they're militarized, so I tend to be very shake my head and be very wary, and so many of these they really believe, like Mossad and different intelligence groups, they just believe they're above the law, this is it's all moving into this area. But look, it's all going to come, really, Chris, it's all going to come to naught, because people are making all these plans for the future, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. This is what's going to happen in the future. There ain't going to be no future. You know, look, I personally felt that we've got an extinction, or something's going to happen to the world. I do believe, so much of my life now is more mystical, not spiritual, mystical, spiritual, certainly not religious. I've never had a religious bone in my body. I gave it away when I was 14. Actually, I was
good for you.
I was I was a Catholic, raised a Catholic altar boy, cum spiritu tuo, and I was about to I went past the shop and they're selling meat pies. It must have been holidays, because normally I'd be at school. And I went, hang on, it's Friday. And in those days, if you ate meat on a Friday, it was a mortal sin, and you went straight to hell, mate. And that's for eternity. No time off for good behavior. And wow. If I put that pie, could something happen, I'd go to hell. I went, hang on, God's supposed to be love. And if I had my mother wouldn't, she'd never do that to me, send me there for eternity. And come on, this is all baloney. And I don't know whether I went and actually bought the meat pie or not, but I suddenly realized I became a heretic. I gave it away at that point. So I was 14, and I just never got, the more and more I know about religion, look, I respect people's religious beliefs, but to me, I don't think any religion has served, I shouldn't say that, but I don't think religion in general has served humanity too well over the last few thousand years.
Now, I want to talk about your spiritual experiences, because I know you have encountered your guides. Before we talk about that, you mentioned that you think there's possibly we could see an extinction level event within our lifetime. I've had quite a few guests that would agree with you, that could think that we're past due for one of these extinction level events. Our magnetic north is moving. We've had a lot of cosmic instances, close calls, you could say, with asteroids, and constantly we've have this space debris, enormous stuff passing by our planet, which could hit us at any time, and especially if this magnetic north keeps moving, that could send us back into the Stone Age or an electromagnetic pulse. Tons of things could happen. So what are your thoughts on this? Because I've had a couple of guests that are of the belief that this could happen within the next 5 to 10 years. We could see something like this.
Within the next couple of decades, within 2 decades, certainly. But I'll answer it this way, because I had The first one was in 2017. I was at Montségur, France, and I was woken up about 2 o'clock in the morning. Usually 3 or 4 o'clock, they wake me up. And I'm happy. I find it an honor to go out and I just write it down. And I don't know what I've written down pretty much until I've written it. And because I always have a little Mac Air with me for this purpose. And it just, I won't even read it all, but it just was Earth, my mother. You know, I am crying, but so few heard my tears. I am dying, but who know of my fears? With little choice but to save myself, that I may live, but yet many may die, as I write myself as I've done before, and will again. So those who now know, who survived the necessary wrath of your mortal mother earth, cataclysm is my saviour. When much will die, many more will cry, yet we will survive. So that was in 2017. So that was the first one, and now five altogether. And the next one was in 2018. I just read a little bit because it says there what it's about. It's a prophecy. And it just says, instead of goodness and kindness, and each according to his or her need, it's been overpopulation and overproduction fueled on by gross ignorance and stupid greed. Though we have already been well warned, yet those dire warnings are still being ignored. Warning by those here wise on earth, as well as those from the deeper beyond. We bear witness to the poor growing poorer, the homeless with even less for their needs, while the wealthy fatten far wealthier, with no limits in sight for their greed. But dark days and nights they will come. They are already visible on our horizon, for planet Earth is left no choice but to rebel by turning our wondrous earth into an unkind hell. So it goes on for a few more, but it goes, I'll read the last one. For to make earth cry means many must die to return the population to that level at where it will be sustainable. Now, the United Nations says, and other scientists have said, that a sustainable level on earth is 2 billion. Now, if you're going to have a sixth extinction, they're talking about 6 billion going. Now, a lot of people say, oh, that's terrible, it's terrible, it's terrible. Well, it's terrible for a lot of people. But the thing is, if if you look at it from a spiritual dimension, not religious, because the major religions give you one life, which you didn't ask for, and though most people, 60% of the world's population don't have a good time. Probably 30% starve. They have absolutely miserable lives. And yet with that one life, you are judged to be a good boy, a good girl. You'll go up here, down there, and boast for eternity. If you, and that's it, one life. If you, very quickly, if you look to the east, with the Cathars, and they were in the west, but if you look to the other ones, which is Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, they believe you have many lives, and the common strand is reincarnation. So they're saying basically you can't do it all in one life. You need many lives to learn, and there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no day of judgment. You go to the world of spirit. Now, so that's, you can call it basically east or west. But the thing is, and I heard this woman on, who was a Christian, who said she'd been quite a strict Christian, and she was a doctor, then she had this near-death experiences. But she was saying that in the United States of America, there's something like 20 million near-death experiences. Now, because I'm interested in that side of things, I've looked at them all, and though they all had their own separate journeys and what happens, and invariably they are met by somebody, often it's a guide or someone to do with their family. But the one common denominator they have, no one, or the ones I've listened to, none of them want to come back. Their home. This is the place on earth is you're coming for a visit for 50, 60, 70 or 80 years. That's the home. And the one thing that they have in common is they don't want to go. So even Socrates said, you know, I'll take the poison because my guide, his guru, who advised him all his life, said, he said it was, if it was no good, he would have let me know. And so, what's the problem with dying? You know, you're going home. This is the place where you're having a hard time. So there's a spiritual element there. So to my mind, if 300 people die for whatever reason, you help them if you can, but if you can't, to me, they're going home, you know? And the other thing is I have, I bang on about it as well, because I go to a spirit medium every year. I've been going for 30 years now. First one was Susie. But my mother, my father are always there. We have a big St. Bernard dog, Lassie. It's always there. Everyone. My friends are there. I've had all my friends, not all of them, but most of my friends have come there. My guides have come there. The Cathar guides that I've been involved with, they're there. They talk to me. But the big thing is, at no time any of these people who are on the other side in the world of spirit, you know, they're just my mother, she just talks to me the same as she normally talks to me. She said, if you don't get a computer, and no mother, there was no computers around when my mother died. She said, if you don't get a new computer, this one's going to crash. I go, hang on, mum, you know. There was another time she said, but these various messages, and they come out, but no one's floating around, and they're just people the same as us. It's just a different dimension, all energy, with the energy here, energy there. They're just a form of energy. They just don't have bodies like we do, but they know what's going on. And the last time I went, my guide was there, and she's ex-Claremont de Foix, and I asked about her, and because I'm changing guides occasionally, and the guy Ezio, he couldn't pronounce the name, and then he said, "Oh, she's John." He said, "They're telling me she's a beauty of unparalleled intelligence." And a couple of times, my father came in. He said, "Yeah, she's a legend." So this is modern speech from my old man, who's been dead for 30 years, and then. Later on, he said, there's some particular message you'll be giving on YouTube. He said, and it'll start to spread. It'll go from 2 to 4, from 4 to 8. And my father popped in. He said, yeah, like the coronavirus. So, you know, there's no. And then this easier said, oh, I said, I'm trying to be a little bit holy here, you know, holy. And my father said, hey, hang on. He said, we have none of that here. He said, even the serious stuff, we said, we treat with joy and humor. You know, so it's what's the problem?
Right.
Dying's a good thing. You're going home, mate. This is where you're visiting. So if you look at it in that context, there's not such a problem when people die. But if you're religious, people who are religious, you're scaring the wits out of these little kids. A little kid of a morning, he ain't got no problems in the world. He's just this and that. And suddenly, by the time his parents, there's heaven, there's hell, there's this, there's that. They go to school, and the kids, he's a psychological mess. He's scared. And I hear kids saying, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. They're not worried about going, but they go to heaven or not. That's not the big deal. The big deal is, I don't want to go to hell. And no wonder people don't want to die. And they hang on day after day because they don't want to go to the day of judgment. If you don't have that stuff. I mean, in China, they got rid of religion. You know, my partner's Chinese, and her family, they haven't got a religious bone in their body. Beautiful people. How do they manage to get by without Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and all the rest of them, you know? Actually, I'll give you something. There, in the world of spirit, there is a thing called a council of elders. And if people have, they go take them back in past lives, and there's a book called, just to give it a minute, but it, A Journey of Souls and Journey of Souls and Destiny of Souls. And the guy, he died a few, but he's the guys, there are thousands of people, and it's a group. And now he's got other people, and they take people back into past lives. I've taken people back into past lives. I've done it for 25 years. And that's just the thing I was going to say. But the thing about that is that when you go back, they do talk, many times they talk about a council of elders. Now, what was given to me was there is this council of elders, but what they are, that all the people in the world, like Jesus or Yeshua, Muhammad, Socrates, not Lao Tzu, because Lao Tzu wasn't actually a person, but all these people.
Ascended masters sorts, right?
Masters, and they're there, and there's a group of bellows, and these people are there, but there's no day of judgment. These are the people you go before, and they talk about how you're getting on and so forth. So if you look at that and you look at it from the point of view that, okay, if you died, okay, we don't get our act together this time, okay, mate, it's not the end. Come around again. So you look at things differently. The soul, here's another thing. The soul, when we think of like, oh, my soul, mate, my soul is actually as though it's an entity. And you know, I've never really thought about it, but from a mystic point of view, and again, just to give an alternate viewpoint to your viewers, a soul doesn't actually exist. What we refer to the soul actually is when you are born, you're born with all your karmic rewards and also your karmic debts. Now, both these things depend how you live your life. You know, you can get rid of your karmic debts, or it's how you go, or you can acquire more karmic debt or more karmic rewards. But if you think of the soul as this concept, which mystics have been looking at it in India and different places, you know, for thousands of years. So it's sometimes how you look at things. And if you look at it, the soul as this way, and what we refer to the soul is actually going down, the Indians call it prana, the Chinese call it qi, we call it life force, the Cathars used to call it the divine spark. But that's basically, that's your innermost core. That's the essence of your being. And your soul is actually this karmic thing. So again, you're just looking at things from a different point of view, a different slant. But what it does, it makes you feel better about yourself. It makes you feel better about yourself, your life. And really, you know, it's even there within the spiritual side, you've got one side trying to liberate you, liberate your spirit and open up your mind and to the universe, to what's out there and all the things that are happening, both hidden and out. And you've got the other one that wants to control you. You know, and religions basically are a form of control. So you've got these two things. There's a battle going on out there, you know, talk about the war and what's happening. So there's a battle out there, or misinformation, disinformation. There's all these things. It's the dualist, really. You know, you can't have light without dark, white without dark, light without or the moon, or the night without day, white without black, health without being ill. So there's a duality of life. So even, and that's not going to really change. You know, that might take different forms, but we're always going to have this duality. You know, you can't have tall without short. You can't have sickness without health. But what's happening is, at the end of it, are you feeling better about yourself and life, or are you feeling down and controlled? In essence, if you live with laughter, happiness, joy, humor, dance, all these positive things, each time you do that, assisting people, care, making someone laugh, smile, what you're doing is that all raises your frequency, you know, whatever it is. But it's raising your frequency. If you're miserable, you're jealousy, envy, hate, this, that, I'll get you bastard, whatever it happens to be, you're lowering your frequency. Now, if you tend to live within higher frequencies, which I feel I do, and I feel that's attributed to my health, because I don't have any health problems. But if you're constantly living in this negative, lower frequencies, ultimately you're going to end up with high blood pressure, cancer, all these various things, because your body can't take it anymore. So life ends up, we're living with our lower frequencies, higher frequencies. So knowledge comes in the quantum mechanics, yeah, quantum physics. You know, it's the electrons, and the one thing is that that if you feel good, the electrons are happy. If you're not feeling good, the electrons are happy.
Yeah, it's amazing. I talked to about four or five different people just this week about this very thing, the power of positivity and living yourself life a certain way, and the energy that you're giving off, and it just comes back to you in just an equally as powerful way. And it's a wonderful thing. Now, Johnny, we have a few minutes left. For the last few minutes we have, I'd like to hear about how you came in touch with your guides, and maybe you could give advice to people that are seeking their own guides, how they may be able to find theirs.
Yes. Well, I went looking. I literally went looking, and I tried. Nearly everything's come to me the hard way. I told a friend of mine about guides and used to listen. We were in the Korean War together, and he listened to me. But then suddenly, there's a book. It's called The Massacre of Montségur, and he said to me, "Oh, there's a massacre of Montségur," and I said, "Yeah, I've been at that book for 5 years. Could you get it for me?" He said, "Oh, I'll get it." And then I'll read it, and you read it. And then 3 weeks later, he said to me, he rang up and he's upset. I said, what's the problem? He said, "Look," he said, "the book arrived." He said, "I went to open it. It's encased in plastic," and I went to open it. And this voice said to me, "I suggest you give the book to Johnny unopened. Do you think all knowledge comes from books? Do you not realize you are a liege, a servant of the Mirepoix family? That they remember the silence in the glade and the flames that consume." And he said, "It's clear as a bell." So anyhow, I opened the book. But he had that guide speak like that. I had to work at it. And then he wrote this book, the dialogues, and it's all these different dialogues. But anyway. Yeah, so I tried this, I tried that. But I got into the I Ching, was one thing, and then I started with the I Ching, and that's a book, you can use it, it's just a book of wisdom, it's nothing to do with religion, and it's just, but you can use that for divination, and I had a good system for doing that. And that tended to bring me in, and that was good, and then I discovered the pendulum. The pendulum was really good because with a pendulum, I could connect, I could say, do I have a guide? Yes or no? And yes, yes, circular. No is this way. And so this is actually with me. It's no to going anti-clockwise is a yes. Most definitely is a going to the right. So I that was a big thing. And that was a breakthrough for me, because with that, I could then double check, because sometimes I'd hear a voice or something would say something, and I go, "Hang on, is that me or my imagination?" And I'd use the pendulum to see if that was right or not. Now, slowly, I got to the stage where my guide, Brenda de Montsefer, at that time, and she would talk to me, and she would just, like we're talking now, she'd say, "John, yes, Brady, Brady, yeah, what do you want?" And she'd talk, and she said, "Oh," I was living with a girl called Julie at the time, and she said, "Oh, Julie went for 5 interviews today." I said, "Oh, yeah." She said, she got a job. I ring her on Monday. So when Julie came home, I said, "Oh, Julie, Brader told me you went for 5 interviews today." She said, "Yeah." She said, "Well," she said, you got a job." She said, "Oh, no way." I said, "They're going to ring you on Monday morning." She said, "Oh, okay." And she rang on Monday morning. So there's all, so that she spoke, and then that went. And then my friend, he was with his guide on his dinner boards, and that was really strong, but he's gone, he's dead now. And then, so I've had this, and then I got into healing, and then I was healing for 5 years, cat, dog, person, no matter what it was, people have had operations on their legs, I heal them. And it was just, but it was the main one that really got me, because animals can't be psychological. And one dog, it was lucky, he was run over by a car, took him to the vet, and the vet said, "Oh, he's got his back broken, but his front and his rear legs have been pulped by the car. Look, leave him here. I'm busy at the moment. Give me a ring in the afternoon." So then they rang in the afternoon, and they said, "Oh, your back can't be broken, because the cat came in, he stood up and he barked." So he said, "I don't know what's going on. Take the dog back." Look, that dog within a week was walking, within 2 weeks was moving rocks, and 3 weeks was running around. But I did a healing on that dog, and so there was, that was not so much what was good for the dog, but it was good for me, because there was no argument that it was actually happening. I was with a person, you could say, oh, well, look, you know, things could happen within that person's brain, especially if it's cancer, because they give ourselves cancer and we can get rid of it. So, but with an animal, it can't happen. So the animal was in birds and cats, and that was good for me to prove to me. But then that then disappeared. And didn't disappear, it would only happen. And now they more or less tell me, you let me know, now this person you need to do. And so to me, the pendulum has been really good, because it gives you a connection. It's just a physical thing that you can check. And but I get up and I'll just have all this information or poems or going around in my head, and I can't sleep, so I've got to get up and then write it down. So that's been happening now for 20 years. And so
you did healings, and it was kind of selected through your guides what to heal. Does this still occur to this day?
Let me tell the last ones that about a few years ago. My dance teacher rang me up, and I'd helped her, because she had a toothache one night and she just couldn't, it was just killing her, and she couldn't have the class. So I took her into the kitchen, and I don't touch people, I put my hands close to them, and you can, and then in that case it was about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, and then she was okay. And then she rang me up, she said, one of my students has Carlos. His mother's got, she's 3 months to live. She got a cancer of the throat. Could you put your healing hands on her? So I said, oh, well. So that was like a direction. So I did that, and I saw him. He took me out. And I did on his mother. She had a tumor on the side of her neck. So I'd given the medicine, so she wasn't in pain. And then, I went to come back 5 days later. That was gone. I did another one. And then, the thing was, about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, we went to Carlos's funeral. He died, and his mother was there, hale and hearty, no cancer. She was it. So, and then another friend of mine, he's a dancer, and he was red in the face and sweating. And I said, you're okay. Kevin, his name was. And he said, well, not really. I said, God, it's Chinese New Year. And I said, happy Chinese New Year. He said, oh, well, my doctor told me, my specialist told me, I won't see another one. I said, what's the problem? He said, I've got a tumor between my ear and my brain. I said, oh, okay. Sorry about to hear that. He said, I don't know why I'm telling you. I haven't told my parents yet, and I haven't told my girlfriend. I said, okay. So I sat down, but I couldn't sit. It's just like a monkey scratching on my back. And I said, oh, I've got to see Kevin. I said, so Kevin, I do a bit of healing. And you're interested? Yeah, I really am. So I came around and to the unit where I am here. And 25 minutes, and that was it. He said, I want to pay you. Oh, by the way, I've never taken a cent. I have a real problem with taking money for people who are ill or sick. I can take money from anybody, believe me, no problem. But if someone's ill or sick, I have a real problem with that. Anyway, that's my problem. So he said, no, I have to pay. I said, no. He said, oh, something else. A bottle of red wine. He said, okay. He said, next time I see you. So it wasn't the next week, but it was 2 weeks later, because he had to see his oncologist. And I looked across when Monica and I, my partner, walked into the room, and I looked in the corner, and there was a pot of red wine on the table. I thought, looks good. I said, how's it, Kevin? He said, good. I said, what did the doctor say? He said, nothing there. It's gone. Okay. I don't know what the doctor asked where it went. And the last one was just only a year ago, 80 months ago. And that was a friend of ours who went there, and she was a nurse, and she had to sign a contract, and her knee, she couldn't stand in the operating theatre, which she loved. And I did one on there, then she bounced around. So I did one on the other one, and that was 80 months ago. So, and, but there's also, very quickly, a friend, Bill, is Islamic originally. He had a pain at the back of his neck. And this is the second time. And it just was there 24 hours a day, all his life. He's had acupuncture, he's been to specialists. He's had everything, CAT scans, MRI, nothing there. He talked to me, he said, well, you've done past lives and things like that, and hypnosis. And I said, yeah. He said, what about trying that? I said, if you want to. So it took about three sessions before he was actually talking. And then we actually did about 5 sessions altogether. But on the last one, because he could always see this group of people on the horizon. They were always threatening, but on this the last session they attacked. This is a past life, and he was a sergeant at arms in charge of these men, and they all ran away. The villagers ran away, and he was left there. And the guy on horseback speared him behind the back of the ear, and that was it. But that was 18 months ago. He had not had that pain since then. So sometimes that can be that. Now, I've had that happen a few times that people have had, that I've done people, done, and I've done up to 85 people, and we had 3 nights. It was for Qantas, the house, and I used to then, when I do a big group, I do a meditation, and I just take them back. But most of those people go to a past life, and then some people get up and talk about it. So again, it's just proof that we've had previous lives. But when you've got that, it gives you there's an inner, it's a pleasant feeling inside to know that this is not the end, you know.
Definitely.
And that we've got to get more lives to learn and live and learn.
Yeah, 100%.
It's all mixed up, Chris. It's all, you know, it's, you know.
Yeah, it's duality.
It's a journey of discovery.
Yes. Definitely. Johnny, that was amazing information, and there's so much more we could cover. I'd love to have you back on sometime in the near future.
Who knows, mate? Who knows? I'd certainly like to chat again. Look, you're a good-looking man, mate. Just looking across there and seeing you, that's reward enough.
Oh, man, thank you so much. Like I said, I'll pay you for that later. But Johnny,
okay, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It was fantastic information.
You,
now, if people are interested in finding your books and more information about you, what's the best way that they can do so?
Simply Google my name.
Google
Johnny
your
Bynum.
Name.
Yeah, here's one. This is this book is Petal, Leaves and Thorns. Now, in it, there's some great poems. There's also some that are about, I give people a hard time, and including Trump and politicians and all the rest of it. But in it is those 5 warnings that I've had about the coming sixth extinction. So that's in there, but I've got it chronologically, so they're not all just sitting together. But that I recommend it because it's also quite funny, and it's as I said before, I think the one thing we the people have got is we can laugh at some of the people who want to give us stuff and shove stuff down our throat and come on, mate. Satire is still the one thing it's still the one weapon that people we the people have worldwide.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely so.
Google my name, and it comes up to YouTube, and everything comes up, and if people want to ever listen to anything.
Yeah, perfect. You're on YouTube. Google your name. You'll find all your books. Johnny, thank you so much for coming on. Like I said, we'll definitely have you back on in the future. There's a lot more we could discuss. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening, and we'll be back again, of course, tomorrow. See you then.